So we're back on the second hour of the Saturday afternoon show on WGXC 90.7 FM from Acre, New York, and through Wavefarm online at wavefarm.org. We're here with Eliza Simons, who's been the Wavefarm artist in residence for the past week and a half. And the first hour, we heard her influences. This second hour, we're going to hear more of her own work and what she's been doing at Wavefarm. Eliza, you play in a couple of different bands or music projects?
Yeah. So this week at Wavefarm, I've been working on an installation involving FM transmitters, but I'm also in a couple of bands, and one of these bands is called Why Lie, spelled with a question mark, and that is me and my pal Dave Reuter, and I play euphonium and sing, and he sings and plays clarinet and guitar and whatever else I guess we can get our hands on. And we also kind of explore, again, narrative, but we also explore pop music. So I'd like to play some songs from our last album, which is called The Cities Who Walk. Actually, if you're interested in checking it out, you can find it at davereuter.com, R-U-D-E-R is his last name, davereuter.com/musical/walkingcities.html. It's available for free download. And the first song I'd like to play is Bad News, and the next one after that is called The Keys and the Caribou.
All right, here we go with that.
I was searching for something. Something in my house somewhere. I looked in the fridge, pulled open the drawers, and pulled my I looked on all the nightset tables, countertops, and other surfaces where I could have put it down. Finally, I gave up and I got in the car. I started driving down the road. I made it about 10 minutes from home when I realized I couldn't remember what it was I was looking for. Sometimes I imagine painting a thin red line of acrylic paint from just below my stomach up to my bottom lip. Other times I imagine peeling the skin right off my muscles, just like I saw a hunter do one time with a caribou. It happened like this. We were sitting in a motorboat and the gun went off just like that. Everything was in bullet time. Everything stood still. The metal inch slowly and casually made its way to the gut of the caribou. Then once we were on the shore, the hunter ran the knife from the heart to the tail. He peeled the skin right off the animal. It was so clean and straightforward. The whole process could have come right out of an instruction booklet, with instructions printed in English, French, Italian, and Japanese. You know how many stars live over the city? 3 on a clear night. You know how many people live in this city? More than you and I could count. You know the feeling when the phone rings in a still house? I still feel a chill in my heart when the phone rings at night. But about that thing I was looking for, what happened was I couldn't stand it any longer, so I drove back. I turned around and I drove back home. I made it to the door of the house when I remembered. And here is what I remembered. The keys I had been looking for were right there in the ignition of the car the whole time.
We're back on the WGXC Saturday Afternoon Show. I'm Tom Rowe here at Wave Farm in Acre, New York, and we're talking to Eliza Simons, who's the current Wave Farm artist in residence, and she's just played a track from her pop band, Why Lie. What was the name of that song?
That one was Keys and the Caribou, and the one before that is called Bad News. And then, so next I'd like to play for you two more songs, but from our newest album, which we're actually working on now. It's called Osuitos, and the first song is called Dumpster Diving, and the next song is called The Werewolf Solution.
I need to be less self-conscious when I'm dumpster diving. If you look up, the windows all have hands and they are waving. On each street corner, there are 100 instruments and they are waiting. I need to be less self-conscious when I'm dumpster diving.
did you find us while we were in motion? An itch without probable cause. The finest of sprays, the most fragrant of lotions, won't stop needle teeth or sharp jaws. Of calamine cures and werewolf solutions, we all hold a thread of advice. Send thousand submissions with no resolution. Don't look back, don't think twice.
We're back on the Saturday afternoon show. Do you want to tell us what those songs were about, or is it pretty self-evident there?
Oh, they're, they're songy songs. I guess I was talking with Dave the other day about this album because we're recording it now, and it occurred to us that we're writing this whole album, and it is... It occurred to us that as we're writing this album, actually every single song is in some way related to generational differences. Maybe a little abstract, but so that's Why Lie. And so that's one collaboration that I work in. And another one is Dr. Zismore. It is a duo of homemade electronic instruments that I build, and also Ian Monroe builds. Ian is a composer and a musician who lives in Brooklyn. He also lives with me because he's my boyfriend. So we play in this duo together, and we build instruments. And the last time that we performed at the Radio Cabaret, which was in Brooklyn, and we integrated homemade FM transmitters also. So the piece that you're going to hear has homemade electronic instruments and also some live FM transmission.
So you were performing in the transmitters and the audience had radios?
Yeah. So the narrative section is spoken into a microphone that goes into the transmitter, and then the audience is actually holding radios so they can only hear the sound of the voice through the radios when they listen to the radios. But the instrumental part is coming out through the monitors, so you can kind of constantly hear that.
All right, well, let's listen. Let's give that a listen.
No longer a clever thing, a nightly occurrence, something to grow accustomed to. Now, they will tell you that if you don't catch it the first time, you're bound to repeat the important parts. It's in the back of the fridge, dear. Let the water run until it gets nice and cold. Proposing a tapering paper trail and trying to mention relevant experience. Her mother left her a note in the jewelry box after she left. Cushioned seat by the window, a tiled floor and shelving unit, fine fibrous root plant. Her mother left her a note in her jewelry box after she left. The note was in her mother's handwriting. It said, "Dear Joy, I am sorry for anything I ever did to hurt you. Your better half says, what a gift. But we all know the long and short of it, don't we? Square patches of light and half a corned beef sandwich. I never got a note like hers, but I did get 3 months in a kingfisher's nest, smelling molded overcoats and not quite making decisions. For example, the decision about what to do with the geranium was never mine, but we threw it out anyway. My better half will tell me. It's not your fault.
Right, that was Dr. Zizmore, one of the projects of Eliza Simons here, who's the Wave Farm artist in residence at the moment and has been showcasing her work this hour. Do you want to tell us more about that, or you've got more other things to tell us about? Do you have any other projects after all those?
Yeah, I do. I guess you could say I have my plate full. So another collaboration that I do is with again with Dave Reuter, who's we're in the YLI band together, and also Lynn Levy, and the three of us are a transmission arts troika, and we're all kind of interested again in narrative and music and broadcasting. So we work together to create works involving FM transmission. We've done an installation that was in actually a stairwell that involved a bunch of FM transmitters. And then we wrote last year an opera together. We're kind of still working on it. It's called To Scale. And it is kind of the story of an architect and his scalies, the little people who live inside of the architectural renderings. and the kind of lives that they lead, and the different characters kind of take place on different kind of wavelengths. Like some characters are broadcast over different radio transmitters, and other characters are broadcast over like the house monitors. So it kind of delves into this realm of, you know, one character is kind of imagining another character, and the imagination is taking place on the radio.
All right, and this this was recorded at the legendary New York experimental venue Roulette?
Yes, this was performed at Roulette, so this recording is from Roulette. This is just a small excerpt of one of the songs in the opera. And the song is actually called The Freeway.
Cars don't want anything. I mean, cars want what I want. Cars want to burn everything. Cars want to burn everything. Oh, turn it into the future. What matters? What matters to a car? What matters to a basket? What matters to a cushion? What matters to a table? What matters to a car? What matters to a basket?
Right, that was The Freeway, recorded live at Roulette. And what's the name of the group?
We're called Cough Button, and that's Dave Reuter and Lynn Levy and myself.
And Cough Button is a radio term?
It is a radio term. It's the button that you push when you need a small silence when you have to cough.
All right. So you've been working on some other radio projects this week, or I guess at least one other radio project this week here at Wave Farm.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm working on now here is actually a little different than all these performance pieces, but again, still kind of deals with narrative and memory and radio waves, natural phenomena. So the piece that I'm working on is called The Tip of the Crest of the Bridge, and it actually consists of 12 FM transmitters, and each transmitter is placed inside of a ceramic housing that I built at my ceramic studio in Long Island City. And it's about the size of an ostrich egg and kind of looks maybe like a hive or a chrysalis, or as my mom put it, an egg potato. And these egg potatoes with the transmitters inside play audio loops. And each of these 12 transmitters are placed, they're kind of hung from strings in the woods. So if you kind of imagine, if you're walking through a pine forest and you happen upon this ceramic hive, you can kind of only listen to it if you have a radio in your hand, and the closer that you get to this object, the better you can hear it. So the piece is interactive. These 12 audio loops, you can really only hear them if you have a radio in your hand.
And then if you do, it draws you in that way?
And then it draws you in.
It almost sounds like a setup for a horror movie. You're walking into the woods and you hear these sounds or voices, and the closer you get, the louder they get.
Yeah, maybe. But actually...
Maybe it's just October.
You know, thing about the piece that I'm interested in terms of narrative and the radio is this kind of intimacy that you can get by holding this object in your hand, and the fact that you have to be close to the object in order to hear it, and you can really only pick up on it by doing this very special kind of listening with the radio. So you're constantly bathed in these radio waves, but you can only pick up on them when you have this radio in your hand. And it just raises some really interesting questions when you involve narrative about memory and ghosts and, you know, picking up on transmissions, I suppose.
And that kind of echoes back to the... when radio first was discovered or whatever, people, there were a lot of, Houdini spent a lot of time trying to see if you could talk to the dead. There was this theory that radio was a delivery device to talk to another realm, most likely the dead or the people that had passed beyond. So Houdini was one of these people, and he was constantly trying to solve that riddle if people could, you know, he was trying to...
hold like a seance.
Well, he was trying to test the seances. He didn't believe they were true and trying to disprove them, I guess is the word I'm looking for. So he was trying to see if, disprove that through the radio.
Something else that you can try at home, kids. I mean, after all, it is approaching Halloween.
Talking to the dead through the radio.
Through the radio.
Here today. So do you want to, you have some files of what this might sound like?
Yeah. So I folks are experiencing the piece today, and, what they're listening to are these audio loops that I edited together. And, you know, this week I was thinking a lot about the audio, and I just can't escape narrative. I just kind of keep on coming back to it. So these are some narratives, some recollections of folks that I know of the houses that they grew up in. And I just asked them to... imagine that they were walking through or around the house that they grew up in and some of the memories that were associated with that. So again, it kind of is this piece where there are these memories that you can kind of only tap into if you're listening to them in a very certain way, these kind of ghost memories. So here are some recordings of that, and special thanks to my friends Esther, Joe, and Marina, whose voices you will hear.
I always went barefoot, so I kind of think of it in terms of obstacles, like paths that you have to take in order not to step on, like, that dead mouse that's squashed in the grass, and that, you know, like, pile of glass that you know is there, or, like, that place where you took some nails out of something and you left them there, and so you can't walk there, so it's, or, like, where there's a lot of thistles on, like, the lane going through the field. So I think about it sort of like a camera that's really low to the ground and, like, my bare feet, and then just, like, weaving around these kinds of, like, small ground obstacles. And then subsequently, I think of a lot of injuries of stepping on things. I also remember that one time we used to steal eggs from the barn because we would get, we wanted to make, like, a little fire, and we were kind of obsessed with, like, cooking real food on these fires because we built little hideouts. And then we would build a fire, and then we'd go looking around for things to cook on those fires. So for a little while, we got really obsessed with cooking eggs. So we would go into the barn and, like, find some eggs that the chickens had left, and then, like, take them and try to cook them on a rock. But I remember one time we did that, we cracked open an egg, and there was, like, a pretty well, like, adult chick in it. And we were, like, kind of horrified and felt really, really bad that we had killed this chick. So we made a little raft for it and put, like, flowers and things all around it, and then sent it on, like, a voyage on the little creek there. And then I remember, like, maybe a week later, I was wading in the creek, and I stepped on it. And I know that's really disgusting, but I was really upset. I had this idea that this little chick had gone all the way down the creek and gone into the St. Joe River, and then gone into the Ohio River, and then gone into the Mississippi River, and then was, like, floating in the Gulf of Mexico somewhere. And so I was really disappointed that I had, like, found this little raft with a chick on it, like, only maybe, like, 20 yards from the bridge. I also stepped on a sigh one time. I got really excited about something, I can't remember what, and I went running to tell my mom, and she was clearing brush with a like one of those big metal scythes. Some people say scythe, but I pronounce things like crick and sigh. Anyway, and I stepped on it, and I like cut most of the like my big toe off. And I remember my cousin, who was visiting, sometimes our cousins stayed with us for the summer. I remember my cousin like carrying me up to the house, and he put me in the sink for some reason. This is all outside. I don't really remember the inside of my house so well. It was just sort of like a big empty farmhouse. There wasn't a lot of, we didn't have a lot of furniture. We had mostly just like books, which were just like strewn everywhere, like books and newspapers and things. My dad is a really neat freak, but my mom is a huge blob. So every so often we would like clean up the house and try to organize everything, and then it would be really strange and like kind of clean. But it would get really messy. I mean, it was just a very dirty house, like bugs and mice and like a basement like full of more junk. And a lot, so we, I don't know, we played outside a lot. So we had an imaginary land called Bungala. So I remember like the parts of the farm, like different parts of Bungala. Like there were parts that were like where the battles had happened, and then there were like parts where we lived and that sort of thing. Mostly marked by like trees or like ravines, or like piles of brush or things like that. Yeah, and I remember working, I guess. We had like 11 acres of produce farm, so, and also goats and chickens and things. So I have a lot of memories of just like weeding, like I would sit on a bin with feed in it while my mom or my dad was milking. And my dad would tell me stories about things. I remember each of the goats kind of had their own personality and their own name and that sort of thing. So I remember like dramas between them. And you know, one time, various things happening to certain goats as they would get out. I remember we had one goat, Copper, who was different from all the other goats because she was an Oberhasli, which is like this, really dark brown, like copper, really beautiful goat. She was more beautiful than all the others. And she was kind of like the princess goat. And I had, secretly I called her Rose, because I really liked this one goat. And then I remember she started developing this huge cyst on her neck. But it was also, it sort of looked like a corsage or something. I don't know. She was still quite lovely, even though she had the cyst, but eventually she died. But then all of the kids, the baby goats that had come from her, were always like that sort of slightly brown color. So her like biological markings kind of passed down to different generations. So I remember which goats were descendants of Copper because they were like had that kind of brown color. And they were always really stupid. I don't know, something about like that lineage of goats that were like beautiful but not very intelligent, and they would always get beat up by the other goats. I remember one year we got a buck goat, and we called him Rudolph Valentino, and he was really, really like, I don't know, he was really wild. So he would jump over like two sections of hog panel, which one section of hog panel is 8 feet, so he could jump 16 feet in the air to get out of his pen and like go running like across the farm to go find the lady goats. He was like always, he was like a stereotype of a male goat. He was really, really like rambunctious and like always jumping and like eating things and like butting people and stuff. That was a good time.
So I'm pulling into the driveway of my old house in Durham, Connecticut, and the driveway is a very long driveway. It's made out of just rocks, and in the winter it gets very cold, and there's ice on the driveway. It's about 3 inches thick, and since I'm four, I think this is really interesting, and my parents will give me a massive hammer, which I'll use to, you know, it's a favorite activity of mine. I just go out and I break the ice with this massive hammer, which is actually pretty exciting because you get all these interesting colors and shapes. And, you know, if you're four, you feel very powerful and interesting, actually being in something to break things with. And the side of the house, it's kind of a bungalow-style house. It's got white paint on the outside that kind of crumbles off, and I like to pick that off. to them for, and that's fun. And then if you go around the house, there is a barn. It's red, and it's all kind of caving in. My parents don't actually do anything with it. They just keep an old a John Deere lawnmower, the kind that you ride. And as a little kid, that's a very exciting, strange place, because it actually has rooms where the roof is caved in and, you know, lots of rusty nails sticking out. And so I wasn't allowed to go in there, but I go in there sometimes. And going into the other side of that, going around the other side of the house, going in the kitchen, go down the hallway a little further, and it's my dad's study. My dad's a professor, and so the book, the room is just full of lots and lots and lots of books. And he smokes then. He's a pipe smoker. So it has this incredibly, you know, sort of dad aura to it. And, you know, big wooden desk, and it smells like pipe smoke. And big chair with, you know, stuffing coming out. And lots of books. That's where he lives. And going through another door, you get to the living room, which is a big, long living room, and this big fireplace, stone fireplace. And I remember at one time, I was five, and my parents were sitting on the couch, and that was when they told me that I was going to have a little sister. And, you know, I was old enough to kind of understand what that meant in some ways. And I was excited about that. I thought that was really cool. So I remember there was some firewood kind of spread out across the front of the fireplace. And I remember saying to my parents, like, oh, well, there's going to be a little kid here. I'm going to clean up this firewood so she doesn't fall over it, which my mom still remembers and thinks it's touching, because, you know, it's a silly thing to be worried about 9 months in advance, but I thought that was necessary as a five-year-old. And around the corner, there's the hallway that leads to the dining room. And I remember that I used to have a tricycle, and I would get on the tricycle in the dining room. And I would ride from the dining room down the hallway into the living room as fast as I could. And my parents would sit there, and each time that I came in, you know, that I rode in, they would applaud wildly and yell out a number that was a completely random number, but, you know, as if it were a score from judges. And they'd be very enthusiastic about it. So as a, you know, three-year-old or four-year-old or whatever, I thought this was a lot of fun. It was basically like racing around the corner and then, you know, the finish line or something like that. On the side of the wall where the windows were, there was a piano, I think, maybe a piano. I remember one time I was being a real jerk to my dad. I don't remember what I said, but I was, you know, being a snotty five-year-old, and he got really angry. My parents didn't, you know, they didn't hit me as a kid, didn't, you know, spank or do any of that kind of stuff, but he was clearly very angry, so he took the mug that he was holding, and he threw it against the wall, like the far wall in the living room, and it shattered, and that was big. That was a big deal, because my dad's a very quiet guy, so seeing him react like that was a very intense moment, and it'd be interesting to remember what that was about. I really don't remember, but so then going down another hallway, there was a room that I don't really remember anything about, except when my sister was born, that was where she lived, that's where her definite was. And there was a bathroom across the way, and I have two memories of that. One, during the 1988 election, my parents voted like George Bush. He was running, obviously, and they taped up a glossy picture of George Bush on the mirror. And each day they would draw something on it, you know, like a mustache or a scar, or, you know. So by the end of the election, she then won. It was this completely grotesque, glossy photograph of George Bush that had been marked up and was on our mirror. And another time I remember finding a pill bottle of my dad's prescription underneath the radiator. And I was debating what to do with it. I think I was maybe four. And I thought about maybe having one of the pills, because I didn't realize, you know, they were powerful, real drugs that you shouldn't have unless you're prescribed them. So I was like, oh, it's basically like candy. So I was thinking about having the pills. But then for some reason, I decided not to, and I just gave them back to my dad. And he was really happy because he didn't know what had happened to the pill bottle. But I was wondering what would have happened to me if I, you know, indulged my four-year-old curiosity and just swallowed the pill bottle. Oh, yeah, the bathtub. I remember I would take a lot of baths, obviously, and my only memory of that was that some memory of my parents putting on an album that I really liked in the living room, which was next door, and I had to be taking my bath, but a part of the song that I really liked came on, and so I had this very distinct memory of being in the bath and being really quiet, trying not to slosh around because I was trying to listen to this song that I liked through the wall. For some reason, that really sticks in my head.
These houses were all over Moscow. It was like a huge building project in the 60s. They were all identical. I mean, there are jokes about people, you know, being able to open other people's apartments with the same key, with their own keys, you know. And even in different cities, because also a lot of the street names were the same in different towns. So there's like a whole movie about this. So it was a very typical four-story red brick house. It was little apartments. Our apartment had two rooms, not two bedrooms, just two rooms. And my parents lived in the living room. They had a fold-out couch. And I lived in the little other room that was separated. There was a door at some point, but it was too heavy for me to open as a kid, so they put a curtain in. And the first thing that you noticed as soon as you opened the door was the bathroom. There was no little hallway or anything. You just opened the door and there was the bathroom, which was tiny. But because we had so many books, my father had built all these shelves everywhere, including the bathroom. And everything was just full of books. So I remember when I was a kid, when I finally, you know, turned five or six or seven or something like that and could be helpful, my dad and I would sit around building shelves, more shelves, because there's no floor space. So you had to just hang everything. And my mom would always call me and say, hey, you made a new shelf. And she'd kind of roll her eyes and be like, oh, God, how many more of these do we have? And the other interesting thing about this house is that across the street, like literally across the street, was the railroad. And there was no passenger station. There were between two stops, but there was a freight station right there. And at night, you could hear the people communicating via loudspeakers, you know, shouting at each other as to where things had to go and where some trains had to stop and which wagon had to get disengaged and things like that. And sometimes they would also curse into the loudspeaker, which was, you know, hilarity ensued. And my parents have a story where, you know, my mom had already fallen asleep and my father was going to go to bed and he had to step over her and suddenly they hear, careful, you're going to run me over. At which point everybody kind of freaked out a little bit because it was just almost uncanny. It felt like those people were in our house. And the other thing that was cool, actually, is that right outside was like a garden. Lots of trees, and even some people had little plots that they planted the, you know, berries in and things like that, which as a kid I used to steal and then get in trouble from my mom because she was afraid that I'd eat the wrong berries. And there were currants, though, the red currants, I remember those. And so we would just play there and dig all these ditches, and our parents would stand on the balcony. On the balcony was where we kept all the wood, so they would build all the shelves. And you know, they would shout for us to come home for dinner. after we're done playing, because, you know, we couldn't really go anywhere because it's dangerous to go around alone as a kid. But the yard was sort of big, I guess we called it a yard, was where we would hang out. And then there were these old ladies sitting at the other side of the house, like, you know, where you would enter the house in the front. They were always sitting there in their little babushkas, and they would gossip all day and give you these disapproving looks and say things about you and your family and tell you, you know, what you were doing wrong, because you're always doing everything wrong, of course, according to them. And then, you know, we'd kind of run from the back to the front around the house multiple times playing hide and seek and things like that. And I had this friend who was my first child. This friend, his name was Paul, and he was really, really short. And so he and I played a lot together. And he made this mooing sound when he ran. You always knew that Paul was coming because he was just running. I don't know if he ever got rid of it. You know, I haven't seen him in many, many, many years. But, you know, that kind of made up for the lack of space in the apartment, which really had no space. And at some point, my grandmother moved into my room. And that was, I guess, seven or eight, my grandfather had died. So I had this, like, you know, very small room that had two people living in it, two people of completely incompatible ages. Well, my parents were in the living room, and then the kitchen was also very small, and you couldn't really fit more than maybe two people in it at once. So any kind of like big meal preparation was an ordeal. You had to, you know, structure it and have an assembly line up the door. And when I was little and we had relatives in town or something, everybody would be gathering in the kitchen to make these cheese pies. And I had to try to be under the table to wash somehow from under the table. It was very difficult. I don't recall how I managed exactly. Seems very unreal now. It doesn't really feel like a place I've been, because it's so different from anything I've experienced since then.
We're here on the Saturday Afternoon Show with Eliza Simons, and we've been listening to some of her own work this hour and work that she's done recently here at Wave Farm. Eliza, do you want to tell us again what we just heard?
Yeah, that was some audio from the installation that's up today called The Tip of the Crest of the Bridge. And that's a piece that I've been working on during my time here at Wave Farm.
Do you have any shows coming up or anything...
Yeah, I do. I do have some shows coming up. I am going to be performing in Performa, which is the performance art biennial. It happens every 2 years, and that's in New York City. I'm going to be performing a piece by a Norwegian composer that happens on bikes and singing. That's actually all the information I know about it so far. But I would highly recommend checking out Performa 13.
Singing on bike sounds like quite a workout.
I feel like I'm up for the challenge. And so I'm going to be performing that. And then coming up in 2014, I am going to be performing Perfect Lives again with my group Verispeed. And that's in Pittsburgh in May. You can look us up. VeraspeedCollective.com. And then in April, I'll be performing actually a brand new Robert Ashley opera called Crash. And that's going to be at the Whitney Museum. Again, something to Google if you have the chance.
All right. So that was Eliza Simons on the Saturday Afternoon Show. Thank you for showcasing your work and some of your influences here.
Thank you so much for having me, and I wanted to take this opportunity also to say thank you to you and to Galen for having me here at Wave Farm. It's been a real pleasure and a really amazing opportunity and experience, So thank you guys so much. And also I would just want to give a special shout out to my parents who drove me here with all of my equipment, my soldering iron and my ceramic housings and all the transmitters. So thank you guys.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in to Eliza Simons on the Saturday Afternoon Show today.